Support for WPR comes from Lake Superior Big Top Chautauqua, presenting concerts, shows, and events under a big canvas tent in Bayfield, Wisconsin, all summer long. Full schedule, tickets, and info at bigtop.org. Support for WPR comes from Monk Botanical Gardens in Wausau with Blossom of Lights, a walking tour through botanical-inspired visual effects, September 18th to October 26th. More at blossomoflights.org.
It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. This time last year, women in Afghanistan could do a lot of things. Teach, practice medicine or law, direct films, perform in public, even star on TV.
In the past 20 years, one of the things that's been booming in Afghanistan is television. One of the most popular TV shows is called Afghan Star, and it's similar to American Idol.
سلام شب و روز شما بخیر با کنسرت ویژه دو فینالیست و دوباران برنامه ما خوش آمدید.
This is Humaira Gilzai.
There are performers that come from all over Afghanistan, men and women. Of course, there are judges that critique what they're doing, and then at the end, there's a winner.
خراب کردن یا خوب ساختن
صدیقه جان ناظرین اول خوبت بگیم که چی یک لباس های مقبول پوشیدین نام خدای کف بلند بر لباس های جان بره استایل جان بزنید
زهرا الهام است باش باید با هنگ زیبایی تو میکنه تشویقش کنید
There was a Pashtun woman who was singing and she was very very popular. She was from Kandahar. And when they were interviewing her, she said that she knows that the Taliban vote for her because she dressed very conservatively and she didn't dance while we sang. So I would say Afghan Star has produced a lot of stars since its inception.
But where will those stars be a year from now? Because in Afghanistan, everything is changing. The new government is widely expected to place severe restrictions on girls, women, and musicians.
I would think that there won't be any concerts that people can attend to. Maybe there will be some speakeasy music performances and such. People will probably go in hiding. I know through other musician friends that people were breaking their instruments, like their beautiful, cherished instruments, and burning them so they wouldn't be caught with it. It's very, very sad. It's kind of like the Gestapo coming. Everybody's expecting them to come eventually.
Humaira Gilzai was born and raised in Afghanistan. Her family fled during the Russian invasion in 1979. Today, she's a cultural ambassador and co-founder of the nonprofit Afghan Friends Network, which, among other things, runs two schools for girls in the Ghazni province. When Charles Monroe Kane talked with her a few days ago, she said that while it's not clear exactly what kind of cultural restrictions the new Taliban government will put in place, things are not looking good for girls and women.
The schools that we started in a rural province has not been reopened. The teachers have been told to not go to school and open it and teach students. Women have been asked not to go to the teacher training institute. So things are starting to really change, and I think we will see it unfolding in front of us.
You know, you touched on something I wanted to ask about, and that you actually run a school in Ghazni province through your organization, Afghan Friends Network. And you told me that the woman who is the director, she's gone. She feared for her life. She ran that school since 2006, and now, boom, she has to leave the country. Is it that serious?
Well, in her case, she was not only the director of the school, but she was a very vocal advocate of women's rights. She also advocated for women to take a role in the elections. She was voted as a representative to go into the lawyer jirga in Kabul and represent the women from her area when they were writing the constitution, which was in 2003. So she's been a known commodity, and she has been receiving night letters and threats from the Taliban for a long time. So her husband and she decided that now is the time that she should leave, because they just felt that the Taliban were soon going to be encroaching into people's homes and finding people who had been advocates and known for promoting things that weren't necessarily in line with the Taliban. Her husband and children have been left behind in Kabul, and we're hoping that we can help them get out.
I want to read something to you. This was Suhail Shaheen. He's the spokesperson for the Taliban. He was speaking to NPR's Steve Inskeep, and this is on the 18th of August. And Steve Inskeep had asked him, and you brought this up, if women who were elected, were they allowed to stay? This is what the spokesperson for the Taliban said on the 18th of August, and I quote, "Yes, women, the women, they have a right to education and to work, and they can hold different positions and jobs right now. The doctors who have started serving, the teachers who have started teaching, also other fields, the women, they are working. The journalist women, they have started working by observing hijab. So yes, women can do their job only if they observe hijab." That seems like, or he's like, yeah, everything's fine. What do you think of that kind of quote?
Well, when you're talking about the Taliban, we Afghans are always saying, who are you talking about?
Who are you talking about?
Yeah. So there's the Afghan Taliban, which even today, this morning, my colleague who I was talking to is saying they're kinder, gentler people, and they care about the Afghan people. Then there's the Pakistani Taliban, who is very influential in Afghanistan, and there's a large percentage of them that are within this fighting force. And they're basically representing the mission of ISI, the intelligence service of Pakistan, and not the peace for Afghanistan. And then there's a third set of Taliban who are currently with this group that has taken over, which is Chechens, Somalis, a lot of people from other countries that are there. And we on the outside really don't even know what their motivation is, other than bringing some kind of Wahhabi, very conservative type of Islam. So the people that you are seeing as representing the Taliban, I always encourage people to say, who are they? Who's doing the fighting? Who's mandating these rules? How is Pakistan affecting all of this? It's a very complicated situation, which is really hard to decipher right away. I think it's going to take some time to really see people's real intentions and motives.
That sounds terrible to me. You don't know who your rulers really are. You don't know, quote unquote, who the enemy is. You certainly don't know what's going to change, what's not going to change. You can even be punished for something. You don't even know what the rules are. That kind of anarchy and chaos is just stressful. And I wonder, like, what's the outlet then? If you're a musician, if you're an artist and you're a woman, what is it that you do? Or you just don't do anything, see what happens?
Well, it's debilitating. It really is. I mean, some of my colleagues are having anxiety attacks. They are homebound, completely unsure of, you know, which family member might get hurt and just crossfire, or if somebody's going to attack them, if their neighbor is going to report them for something. I have to say, very prominent directors, female film directors, such as Roya Sadat, Sara Karimi, and Shahbanu, they all got out of Afghanistan. They are prominent advocates for women and beautiful work, and they're not able to continue their work in Afghanistan. I think a lot of people have gone underground, but I can tell you that the amount of anxiety and frustration and sadness and shame I have been feeling here in San Francisco, theirs is at least 1,000-fold more. Maybe not the shame part, because as an American, I'm very ashamed of what has happened to the Afghan people. But the fear, because my family escaped Afghanistan when the Russians invaded. And, you know, we still carry that in our body. We carry that trauma.
Mm. The school you ran, it's closed, right? Now.
Yeah. And Charles, I feel so sad for our students. I mean, these girls worked so hard. They would come to school early in the morning. They would stay late. They would offer to help in the school to, you know, upkeep. The parents would come. The fathers would fix the roof. And when the Taliban came in the province to take over, I mean, they were fighting on the roofs of our school. All the windows have been shattered. There are bullet pockmarks on all the walls. All the posters we had of poets and scientists and such have been ripped and torn apart. My heart really breaks for these girls who really thought education, and even boys, boys were working hard too, that education was going to be their way to, you know, a better life, to improve their communities and such. And that is all at this point in great jeopardy and possibly not going to happen.
I'm sorry. I just want to say that at this moment.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I think what's important as you're talking to realize for me is that you were a refugee. You were a refugee. You came to America via Germany and Pakistan for years in refugee camps, and you end up in America. There are a lot of Afghan families who are on the same journey you were on. What advice would you give to them?
Well, I came here as a child, so my parents experienced what the adults of these refugees are going to face. And I want to tell them to hang in there, because the first years are going to be hard. They have to learn the language. I know some of them are translators, but the wives may not speak English. Their children may not speak English. If their parents came with them, they may not speak English. So there's the language. There's the whole idea of that you were somebody in your previous country and you're nobody here. You have to start completely from scratch. Everything you have done and built is erased overnight. And here you are with what is the knowledge in your head and what you have in your suitcases. So I would say, but don't lose your pride. Don't lose your dignity. Don't lose hope, because I think if you have that integrity and that hope that you are somebody, that even on those days where you walk into a grocery store and you have $10 in your pocket and you have to buy food for your family, which is what my parents had to do, ration our food, electricity and such, you still bring that humanity with you from Afghanistan, and that should not be forgotten. And that even though they have lost everything, that they're not devalued as a person. And I think that that is something that a lot of immigrants struggle with.
I have one last question for you, and because I've been thinking about her a lot. So the woman who ran your school.
Yeah.
You guys talk all the time. You said, like, what would be the decision to go back?
To Afghanistan?
Yeah. Like, when will she go back?
She's not going back. No. She is at Afghan Friends Network. We're trying to raise money to help her bring her family out. They will probably be in Turkey for a while. And we are working with her to either get asylum for her in Canada or the United States. Because what she has decided, despite the fact that she was a prominent figure and her husband is a doctor, that they will have to sacrifice their careers and such in order to have a future for their kids. And that is the decision that my parents also made, is to sacrifice everything they had worked for
and left their home and everything in Afghanistan in order to make a better life. And I so deeply respect her for this, but I so deeply fear for her because I know what compromises my parents made when they came here and started a life again. So she has a long road ahead of her.
Humaira Gilzai speaking with Charles Monroe Kane. She's the co-founder of the nonprofit Afghan Friends Network. The last we heard about that endangered school director, the U.S. State Department has not responded in any way to her application for refugee status. And as for her husband and children, they can't leave Afghanistan without visas, and the foreign embassies are still closed. Humaira is looking for ways to help. Coming up, for most women, leaving Afghanistan is not a choice, especially in the rural areas where wars have come and gone for centuries, and the patterns of life can seem unchanging.
A deep breath, and suddenly I pictured us the way a bird would see us. A white dove cast off course, or a demoiselle crane perhaps halfway on its hallowed and time and again desecrated migration across the big slate sky. Two people working, a woman carrying food, an importunate visitor, and an old man barefoot in his black galoshes, his glasses held on his head by string. His Soviet shotgun, a poor match for the war around him. Five tiny and fragile figures in the sodden desert, a poor man's carpet decocted out of an eternity of violence and generosity and grace. Each of us flawed and so complete. All of us woven into a time warp. Name, Oka.
Life among the women rug weavers in the village called Oka. Next. This is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX. In 2011, journalist Anna Batkin spent the better part of a year in an unmapped Afghan village called Oka, where women and children practice a tradition nearly as old as history, carpet weaving. And I want to go back to the conversation Anna Batkin had with Steve Paulson, because the vast majority of Afghans live in remote rural areas, places like Oka, where foreign wars and invasions have come and gone. While Anna was there, women sat in mud huts weaving, while American fighter jets passed overhead. That juxtaposition of beauty and violence is what she tried to capture in her book, The World is a Carpet.
Any rug merchant in the Khorasan will tell you, two factors determine the beauty of a carpet. One is the density of its knots. An experienced carpet dealer will count the knots by ear, running his fingernail across the hard ridges on the reverse side of the rug. The higher the pitch of the scraping sound, the finer the yarn, the closer together the knots, the longer the carpet will retain the luscious bounce of its pile. The dealer also might fold the carpet and press on the fold. The wool of a tightly woven carpet will spring back after the rug is unfolded, leaving no sign of a crease. Designs are plenty, but which design a customer finds attractive is only a matter of taste, of subjective preference. True beauty, on the other hand, is indisputable.
That is wonderful. Thank you. Now, one thing that I found fascinating in your description of the making of these carpets is perfection is not actually that highly valued. In fact, one of the signs that these are handmade is that there are flaws in the carpets.
Well, first of all, in the Muslim tradition, perfection, man-made perfection, offends the omnipotence of God. So perfection is not allowed in a carpet. And sometimes a weaver will, on purpose, weave a mistake into her carpet. That usually is not necessary because a carpet takes on the shape and the life of a weaver because it's woven over a long period of time, you know, between 4 and 9 months. And so there will be a moment when the weaver is distracted because a goat had stumbled into or onto her loom and she has to stand up and get the goat away. Or, for example, a neighbor came in and started gossiping and the weaver started laughing and forgot the count of thread and had accidentally woven an extra petal into a stylized almond tree, and so on and so forth. So each carpet is unique and becomes the diary of the carpet weaver.
Hmm. The woman who you focus on, the particular weaver, is named Thaura. What was she like?
Very taciturn young woman in her early 30s, probably, because most Afghans who are illiterate, and most Afghans are illiterate, very rarely know how old they are. Who wants to count the seasons of privation? Very quiet most of the time, but very open to sex gossip and giggles a lot when somebody comes in and tells her dirty jokes. She is a mother now of 3 children. She is one of the few women in Oka who does not take opium as a palliative because her father-in-law forbids it.
Hmm. So opium is widespread in this village?
Opium is omnipresent in this village because there is no other way to keep aches and pains at bay. There are no doctors nearby. There are no clinics. There are no pharmacies. So the only thing that you can use when you have a backache, and you almost always have a backache if you live in Oka, or a stomachache, you take a little bit of opium. If your child is crying because he's hungry or he's teething, you give him or her a little bit of opium. If you're pregnant and you have a backache and you feel nauseous, you take a little bit of opium. So you're exposing your child to opium prenatally. So basically, it's a village of addicts.
Wow. And also a village that makes extraordinary carpets.
It's a village of people who tell amazing stories. It's a village of people who are extraordinary hosts. It's a village of people who are probably sinners, and some are magnanimous, and some are greedy, and some probably are thieves. And it's a village that is a sliver of humanity. It's a village of people just like us, just in different circumstances.
How did Thaura learn to make carpets?
She doesn't remember. Her daughter, Leila, who was 5 or 4 years old when I was in the village, was already helping her weave. So probably Thaura was 4 or 5 years old when she was helping her mother weave. And her mother probably was 4 or 5 years old when she was helping her mother weave. This is how the craft is passed down.
This is a very poor village, and the families who make these carpets earn something like 40 cents a day. And then by the time they get to the United States, they sell for thousands of dollars, right?
Carpets that are exported out of Afghanistan can travel either west to Istanbul or east to Islamabad or Peshawar in Pakistan, or they can fly out of Kabul south to Dubai. And that is where they become extraordinarily expensive.
How much are they sold for?
Here in the States, between $5,000 and $20,000 per carpet.
Wow. Which kind of makes you wish that the women who actually make them made more money.
A lot of things make me wish that women who make carpets made more money. Not just the price, the exuberant, extortionist price of carpets that people pay for them here, but also the fact that, oh, I wish for these women healthy children who don't die of common cold that goes untreated and then becomes something worse. I wish for these women stomachs that are not so empty. I wish for these women ibuprofen when they have a headache, you know, a warm pair of socks in the winter.
Yeah. Did you feel like your job was essentially bearing witness? You were the person giving testimony of how these people are living?
You were saved not in order to live. You have little time. You must give testimony. That's a poem from a poem by Zbigniew Herbert, a Polish poet. That's sort of my lodestar. I guess that's also how I comfort myself when I feel very upset with how little I can do. You know, I'm a storyteller, and I think that the idealist in me believes that somehow my storytelling can make the world a little closer.
Anna Badkin, talking with Steve Paulson back in 2013. Her book about the women weavers of Oka is called The World is a Carpet. And her most recent book is Bright Unbearable Reality, Migration as Seen from Above. So I want to tell you about an Afghan girl, a teenager who called herself Rahila Muska. She lived in Helmand, the former Taliban stronghold. Like many young and rural Afghan women, she wasn't allowed to go to school or even leave home, but she did find a voice as a poet. Here's one. I call your stone. One day you'll look and find I'm gone. Muska wrote Landai, an incredibly ancient form of spoken word poetry widely shared among Pashtun women, often in secret, and as a way to express forbidden thoughts and feelings. On the day Muska's brothers discovered her poetry, they beat her very badly. In retaliation, she set herself on fire, and she died. And Muska's story and poetry would have died with her if it weren't for the American journalist and poet Eliza Griswold and her collection of contemporary Afghan Landai called I Am the Beggar of the World.
Landai means a short, poisonous snake. And this form, the Landai, is spoken by women, for women. It's transmitted ear to ear, voice to voice, and has been over millennia. And it's very subversive. The things that women speak about, the issues of sex, war, longing, grief, separation, are issues that they're really not allowed to talk about in day-to-day life. And so the Landai, because it's collective, because it's anonymous, and because it's oral, allows women to share their innermost sentiments and disown them at the same time. For example, Rahila Muska, the young woman who was killed, could utter that Landai because she could say, well, that's not my poem. And although after her death, her father destroyed the notebooks that survived her, he was unable to kill or to wipe out a poem that was an oral tradition and had been passed among women for centuries.
I can't think of any other poetic form anywhere that is almost exclusive to women.
I think that's exactly right. And one reason women have particular purchase over the form of the Landai is because, of course, the women who are speaking these poems are largely illiterate. They can't read and write. And the Landai becomes, as it did for Rahila Muska, an ongoing form of education and a way of speaking when there was no other form allowed to her.
They're so compact. I mean, these are like haikus in a way, but they're kind of dense with emotion. And I wanted to ask you about some that seem to be love poems to American soldiers, or actually they're sort of more like love-hate poems. So there's one, for instance, my lover is fair as an American soldier can be. To him I looked dark as a Talib, so he martyred me. Wow.
Yeah, Now, that's an old one. And it used to say, my love is fair as a British soldier can be, because it is a tacit criticism of occupation. And of course, long before the Americans set foot in Afghanistan, there was the 19th century British occupation.
So there's a sense in which the soldiers are simply interchangeable. It's one more occupation for this area.
Oh, absolutely. The soldiers are interchangeable. Occupation is interchangeable. The enemy is interchangeable. And yet the idea of being misread, misunderstood, seen in a mistaken form, that the outsider is so blind to Afghan life that he will not understand or recognize his own lover. That's what stands at the heart of that poem.
There are also some really chilling anti-American poems. There's one, I kind of couldn't get it out of my head. Wait, let me find it. This one's written by a mother. My Nobby was shot down by a drone. May God destroy your sons, America. You murdered my own.
Yes. The name of this mother was Chandana, and she did not sing this poem to me directly. This was repeated to me by her cousin. So she never would have written this poem because she cannot write. So this is just an oral tradition, and she would sing this. She did sing this at a wedding. And men and women are segregated for weddings, as they would be for any ceremony in Afghan society. And so in a women's wedding, typically at henna night before she's married, when the bride is decorated with henna on her hands and feet, women sing land eyes. They sing them with a small hand drum called a daira. And yes, this mother, to her understanding, he was killed by a drone. Now, does she know that for sure? No way. But the drones are very prevalent in Afghan society now, in both the common consciousness and the rage against ongoing occupation, but also in the land eyes, which was shocking to me that they'd entered the language of the land eyes themselves.
Well, so some of these seem to be supportive of the Talibs, but then others aren't. There's one, may God destroy the Taliban and end their wars. They've made Afghan women widows and whores.
Mm-hmm. There's rage against all forms of oppression in these poems. And the Taliban, you know, they're not popular. Here's what happens in a village. And this is why women sing about the Taliban with such disgust. In a village, the Taliban will come through and demand that a family give over one of their sons. And so that leads to rage, because in the same way that Chandana would sing about her rage at the Americans for killing her son Nobby, she would sing about her rage at the Taliban for taking one of her sons for their ranks as well. And moreover, because women have suffered so much under the rule of the Taliban regime, which still rules and has parallel governments in much of rural Afghanistan today, the hypocrisy of the religiosity of the Taliban, and yet the way in which when they were in power, they, you know, abused women, that really is a common theme of both women's talking to one another, but of course of the land eyes as well.
You know, one of the things that's really interesting to me is the women's voices as they come out of these are so powerful. I mean, they just kind of jump off the page at you. And these are not the voices of shy or modest or humble women. Did that surprise you?
It did and it didn't. I mean, because I've been working in Afghanistan for more than a decade on and off, I had some sense of the volubility, the rage, the earthiness that with which many Afghan women speak all the time. And as sort of, you know, I wear a couple of hats as a journalist and a poet. And so I love sort of looking at the edges of society. For both me and for the photographer Seamus Murphy, with whom I was working, who's worked in Afghanistan for 25 years, one of the things we wanted to do is sort of explode the image that we have in the West of an Afghan woman being you know, a mute ghost beneath a blue burqa, because she is anything but. And the frankness with which women speak is woefully underreported because there's not much space for it in the news headlines. So what we were trying to do is get beyond those headlines and let these women speak for themselves.
And yet, at the same time, they may have strong voices, but so many of these poems are about their oppression. The really heartbreaking ones to me often are young girls who clearly are being married against their will. Oh, what's the one there's something about, I dropped the spinach on the floor.
Oh, yeah.
How does that one go?
That one goes, today I dropped the spinach on the floor. Now the old goat stands in the corner swinging a 2x4.
Is there a Landai you would leave us with?
Sure. When sisters sit together, they are always praising their brothers. When brothers sit together, they are selling their sisters to others.
Poet and journalist Liza Griswold. Her collection of Afghan women's poetry is called I Am the Beggar of the World. And we were talking shortly before it came out, back in 2013. But I wanted to revisit our conversation today because with the Taliban back in power, listening to and cherishing the voices of Afghan women is more vital than ever. So we're talking about sisterhood this hour, between Afghan women and Western women. And how have we in this country measured up as sisters? Not well, according to my next guest. Do you think feminism was invoked in order to build support for the war and that American mainstream feminists were basically duped into supporting it?
Yes.
Stay with us. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Feminism should mean women supporting each other across cultures and continents, right? A global sisterhood. Except that some of us have not been very good sisters. That's the message of Rafia Zakaria's new book, Against White Feminism. Zakaria is an author, an attorney, and a human rights advocate. She grew up in Pakistan, and she's served on the board of directors of Amnesty International. And lately, she's been thinking about the day in 2001 when Colin Powell announced American invasion plans with the backing of a group of prominent American feminists. And that's why Zakaria calls it the first feminist war.
That was probably one of the first times in modern history that the feminist movement, the U.S. or Western feminist movement, instead of serving as a check on state power, as it had even in previous wars like Vietnam, essentially allied itself with the war project. So all these women, all these American women, Hillary Clinton and Madeleine Albright, Laura Bush, even Gloria Steinem, supported this action, even though at that time, there were indigenous Afghan feminists on the ground who were very, very against the occupation and the invasion and were arguing for peace.
Well, I mean, the idea at the time was that women and girls in Afghanistan were living under oppressive conditions and that getting rid of the Taliban would not only strike a blow against terrorism, it would also open the door to more rights for those women, like education in a country and which, what, 30% of the women are illiterate, and jobs and the right to self-determination. So what's wrong with that argument?
What was wrong was you cannot simultaneously bomb a country into the Stone Age and then also say you're going to empower and uplift its women. That's one society. Women and men don't form a separate society anywhere. The problem with the goals was that they were used as window dressing to hide the mayhem and the night raids, home raids,
people being dragged away for months, no one knowing where the father or the brother has been taken, just extremely intrusive and demeaning tactics used by the U.S. military, who, you know, was fighting a war in Afghanistan. The consequence of that is that those good goals, whether it's education or empowerment or job training, they become delegitimized because they're attached to this very painful and derogatory foreign occupation.
Do you think feminism was invoked cynically, deliberately by the administration and the military in order to build support for the war, and that American mainstream feminists were basically duped into supporting it?
Yes. And I understand the temptation, because essentially American feminists at the outset of the war were told that, look, you guys are feminists, you guys are strong, you guys are empowered, and we're going to export you and your greatness to this environment where women are oppressed. And this narrative was a very, very convincing and very, very, you know, a narrative that essentially placed the United States on high moral ground. Even though, I mean, you know, it was repeating a very colonial message of white men going and saving brown women from brown men, which is, you know, the famous adage.
Well, we should talk about Zero Dark Thirty. The movie came out in 2012. It's a fictionalized story about the CIA agent who was involved in the hunt for bin Laden. But you tell just a riveting and an actually really painful story about watching it. What was it like?
Yeah, you know, I went to watch the movie. I was in Indiana at the time, and it was the most isolating and just emotionally wrenching moment, because the entire dramatization of that movie is around this idea that a strong woman, undoubtedly a feminist woman, is one who is willing to torture and hurt men who look like my father and my brother and all of my family. You know, I was watching this movie against a larger environment in the United States where, you know, my brother himself had been questioned by the FBI for no reason whatsoever. And I knew a lot of other people who were in a similar position. So watching Americans uncritically embrace and digest this person, the CIA agent, who, you know, it's like there's a famous line in that movie when they first hear the girl, she's a killer. And being a killer was supposed to be this ennobling thing. And I saw in that movie and its reception almost like a culmination of what the Bush administration had commenced.
As the coalition force occupation went on and the whole humanitarian aid project really ramped up in Afghanistan, we began seeing more and more stories about shelters for women and schools for girls and women getting jobs in government. Pragmatically, did women's lives improve?
Look, I mean, I won't lie that as a feminist myself, I'm not from Afghanistan, but neighboring Pakistan, and this is typical of a lot of projects that try to empower women. So in the short run, yes, there is an improvement, right? There are women in government. There are more women working. There are more universities and schools open. But because this was such a top-down thing, right, where the money was coming externally, there was really no cultural or political buy-in to the increased presence of women. Mm-hmm. It was essentially a gamble that, okay, let's just get women in these roles. And once they're in these roles, that might foment some kind of a cultural transformation and social transformation in Afghanistan. And of course, like, you know, the events of the past couple of months have shown that that's not true.
Well, you're talking about the dangers of trickle-down feminism, your phrase, this idea that what women everywhere in every country need is the kind of life that middle to upper middle class white women have, a world in which every woman wants a career and a glass ceiling to bust.
That's exactly right. And that was the, you know, core kernel. Trickle-down feminism was how women's empowerment within Afghanistan basically failed.
How much of this do you think goes back to colonialism, which, you know, seems to have left its sticky traces on everything?
Oh, I mean, yes, you know, the book starts from the colonial era for that reason. For instance, I present the example of Gertrude Bell, this British woman who goes out to the Middle East at a time when the British Empire has essentially conquered all of the Middle East. And she goes saying, I'm a person in this world. I'm a person in this world, which what she means is, you know, she doesn't even have the vote back home in London, but she goes to Jerusalem and to Haifa. And over there, being a white woman means you're still above brown men. And so there's this sort of immediate racial privilege that is accrued to you. And, you know, you see the same sort of tropes kind of repeated in Iraq and Afghanistan, where white female journalists from the United States, New York Times journalists who went out there. And of course, yes, they are above brown women and brown men in that society. And so you have them exercising their white privilege in sort of careerist ways, such that they appear feminist heroines to the women back home, but they're really part of an oppressive racial hierarchy.
That's, you know, let's just tease that out just a little bit, because it's not immediately obvious to me. And I'm not sure that I would agree with you that all these women war reporters and journalists went out in a blatantly careerist way. It seems to me that it's more like they went and profiled girls going to secret girls' schools and women running book clubs. They used their gender as a way in, with the intention, probably good intentions, of simply telling women's stories. But the question is, when does telling somebody's story become using somebody's story?
The point when it becomes predatory is that in a lot of cases, the women that they were writing about stood to be actually physically harmed from the story. So, for instance, Lindsay Addario, the Pulitzer Prize winning photographer, right? When she talks about going into a secret school, hiding from the Taliban, and she takes pictures of those girls, she's endangering those girls, because that's the whole point of the secret school, right? It exists so that the identities of those women won't be known and they can continue to operate this school. So when you take that picture and it's published in the New York Times, it's obviously no longer secret. But nobody even considered that in that story. Hmm. And it's that part to me that is disappointing.
And that's where the legacy of the kind of Victorian patronizing benevolence comes in. It's like, as long as it seems like we're motivated by humanitarian reasons, it can be easy to treat the people you're trying to help as victims and assume that you know what's going to be good for them.
It's important to recognize that white feminism gets some of its sort of self-righteousness from presenting that contrast between the white woman as progressive, forward-looking, pioneering, and all other women as oppressed and far, far behind in their journeys to feminism and empowerment. And the fact is that's simply not true. It comes from the colonial era, definitely, right? And it's ironic to consider that now, for instance, one of the visual comparisons that's always drawn is the burqa. These women are covered, the burqa. You know, back in the Victorian age, women were going to India and they were scandalized by the saris because they were showing too much flesh. How are you showing your midriff? And, you know, this is so bad. It doesn't matter what it is. It becomes a subject of derision because it doesn't accord with the white feminist project of the moment.
So going forward, what would real sisterhood be?
I think real sisterhood would be a very intentional and pointed effort to have these difficult conversations around race so that we can recognize the real battle, right? The larger battle, which is against patriarchy. Mm-hmm. I really think that this can be done.
Yeah, I actually think it's a really exciting and potentially transformative time.
I completely agree with you. Yes.
Rafi Zakaria is an author and human rights advocate. Her new book is called Against White Feminism. And that's it for today. This hour of To the Best of Our Knowledge was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with help from Shannon Henry Kleiber, Angelo Bautista, and Mark Rickers. Our technical director is Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and I'm Anne Strangehamps. Thanks for listening.